Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's hard to get excited. We've heard it all before when it comes to peace in the Middle East. Now the cover of Time magazine says Israelis don't care about peace anymore. They're so secure and prosperous, and Palestinians are literally divided. And yet, there are voices saying this could be the time, that the way is there. This hour on Point, hard experience and hope in the Middle East. You can join the conversation. What are you thinking as peace talks roll again? Will they be over next week if settlement building starts again? Or could this be the time? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On the plane, on the way to Egypt, where the Israeli Prime Minister, the Palestinian President, sat down at Sharm el-Sheikh today, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke with reporters about the path ahead.
For both of these men, this is a moment of great opportunity as well as challenge. And what we are attempting to do is to encourage them to pursue this chance for peace this year, because neither of them can predict the consequences if this effort does not continue forward.
On the plane, on the way to talks, and in Sharm el-Sheikh today, U.S. Envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, said all parties are kind of on the same page.
All of us reaffirmed our commitment to reaching a shared goal of a just, lasting, and secure peace. Our common goal remains two states for two peoples.
There's the big goal. There's a lot of skepticism. We'll hear later in this hour from Aaron David Miller, the longtime U.S. Middle East negotiator and peace advocate, who's now very sober on the prospects for peace in the region. But we will also hear from two Israeli and Palestinian who say it can be done and now is the time. First, from Jerusalem, we go to Edmund Sanders, Jerusalem bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Edmund Sanders, thanks very much for being with us. What have you heard out of Sharm el-Sheikh? What was achieved, what not, and what about the settlements issue?
Well, not much was achieved as far as what we've heard so far. They did meet. There was a little bit of a moment of hope when they decided to have an unscheduled second round of talks later in the afternoon. But it doesn't appear there have been any breakthrough and perhaps not even much progress, specifically on the settlement issue, which is what everyone is very concerned about, of course. If that doesn't get resolved, then the rest of it perhaps is meaningless.
There's a moratorium, of course, that the Israelis had on this. It's due to expire on September 26th. That's coming right up. Washington has called on that to be extended, but there's been no promise of that. Does it look like there's wiggle room to keep everybody? And Palestinians have said they'll go if the moratorium ends.
There's really nothing new on that today. I mean, Palestinians have stayed very firm in their position that there's no room for negotiation on that. Over the weekend, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sort of opened the door for that. He said perhaps we could have a middle point, a limited freeze, or some kind of a compromise. But Palestinians, even today, after presumably a lot of pressure from the U.S., have not really relented on that. The U.S., as you mentioned, has said now three times in the last week that they think Israel should just keep the moratorium, that it's while we're in peace talks, that it just makes sense to continue on with the moratorium. So it's very unclear where this is headed. At the same time, though, the U.S. is also signaling, I think, to the Palestinians very strongly that if Israel doesn't extend the freeze, they still expect the Palestinians to stay in the talks. Whether they will or not, that's what everyone is wondering.
Is the Israeli Prime Minister making some noises about formally ending the moratorium, but sort of, keeping the brakes on? There are a lot of, permitted projects ready to go, we read here. Is Netanyahu saying, well, the moratorium will end, but we really won't go, full throttle into building or not?
Publicly, he's not really saying very much at all. In fact, on Sunday, were like his first comments in weeks, really, about the issue. There is a huge backlog. There's at least 2,000 units ready to go immediately, another perhaps 10,000, according to some estimates, that could break ground. And certainly the settlement community and the right-wing community is very eager after 10 months to resume construction. The possible compromises that are floated around are perhaps only building in certain areas and certain blocks, that the large settlement blocks that are expected to be part of Israel in any kind of a settlement. Netanyahu is also apparently considering perhaps some sort of a limit, maybe 2,000 units a year, which was approximately what his predecessor was building. I think that he's open to, and he signaled that he's open to some kind of compromise. But from the Palestinian standpoint, which they reiterated today, their position is that, it's hard to negotiate the end of the occupation when, in their sense, it is continuing every day with more construction on land that they believe is theirs.
Edmund, when Hillary Clinton speaks, and she has repeatedly, of this being maybe the last chance for a very long time anyway to get to peace, what does she mean by that?
Well, there's been just a huge frustration, and as you were noting, too, skepticism among the people about the peace process. It's been 17 years. A new poll out in the papers here today showed that 70% of the people don't think this process will lead anywhere. And that's pretty consistent with what we've been seeing for years. So people are just have really given up hope that the peace process can achieve anything. So there's that. Also on the Palestinian side, for Palestinian Authority President Abbas, he said he's not running again. He's put his whole career basically on the peace process. And a lot of people feel this is sort of his last time at the table. If this falls apart for him, that the Palestinian people who are sort of on the fence on him in any event, according to the polls, in terms of their support for him, will really just give up on him. And the fear is give up on the peace process and perhaps shift towards other methods such as violence, such as Hamas, armed resistance or nonviolent resistance, other strategies. They just don't feel that the peace process has delivered anything after so many years.
So not forever. Hillary Clinton likes to say last chance. Edmund Sanders, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Ed, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Here is the U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. This is September 3rd in an interview with Israeli and Palestinian TV broadcasters. She was asked what makes this round of peace talks different from all of the peace talks that have flopped over the decades.
It's clear to me that the forces of growth and positive energy are in a conflict with the forces of destruction and negativity. And the United States wants to weigh in on the side of leaders and people who see this as maybe the last chance for a very long time to resolve this.
The forces of growth and positive energy. Let's hear right now from two who say it can be done. Joining us from Tel Aviv first is Gadi Baltiansky, Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Israel. It's a joint Israeli-Palestinian effort to promote peace through a two-state solution model. He's former press secretary to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Gadi Baltiansky, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Ramallah in the West Bank is Nidal Fukaha. He is Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Palestine and head of the Palestinian Peace Coalition. Nidal Fukaha, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Gadi, let me come first to you. I mean, Americans have seen all of the ducks lined up here, and at the same time, we've been showered with quite skeptical commentary about what might come out of this. The cover of Time magazine, in the U.S. anyway, Why Israel Doesn't Care About Peace, and we're reminded, we'll ask Nidal about it, Palestinians are divided between Abbas and the Hamas movement. I mean, what gives you hope that it can happen this time, anytime?
Allow me first to disagree with the headline. I think Israelis do care about peace. But I think that there is a lot of skepticism, and indeed, it is natural to face disappointment and low expectations after years of failure. And yet, we don't have a better choice since we live here, and we have we want a better future for us and our children. Nobody has a better solution than peace than a two-state solution. I don't know if this time will bring a solution in contradiction to others, but I do know that we should try. I do know that there is a room for a compromise. We all know what the solution can look like, should look like. Some of us oppose it, but I think majorities in the two peoples support it, and this is different from the past, and we should let the majority decide and encourage our leaders to take courageous decisions.
Nidal Pukaha, this issue of settlement is right in the middle of everything already. The meetings have already wrapped up in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, but this isn't resolved. I mean, we're talking about the case that it could be done, but could all this be over, you know, a week from now?
Well, you know, the whole issue of negotiation is about defining the borders of the Palestinian state. And if the issue of settlement will remain, if the freeze will not continue after the 26th of September, I think this will put the whole peace process, which was relaunched recently, at a risk, because at the end of the day, as you just mentioned, yes, the Palestinians are divided, and what I'm really concerned about is the internal division within the national Palestinian stream, who are the traditional supporters of the negotiation. And the only way in order to bridge this gap between the two sides, internal, the national stream, and to end this split, is continuing the freeze of settlements, which will be, which will cast the voice of those who pushed for going to negotiations once again with Israel.
Gadi, we're going to look at the fundamental cause for reasons for optimism, or that could be done here, but might it all be over in failure next week on the 26th?
I don't think it will be over next week, as I don't think that we will have peace next week. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a process. We will see ups and downs. There will be more than one crisis, and I don't know what will happen in 1 week. But I think for the long run should not be too long, but it's a matter of months. And if we fail in this round, we should try again. The issue of settlements is indeed important, as my colleague said, because, you know, you cannot negotiate a pie and eating it at the same time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's the sound of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton chatting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh this morning, just before a second round of negotiations over Mideast peace. Negotiations that have been off, talks that have been off for a long, long time now. There is a lot of skepticism about this, but we're talking today with two believers in Mideast peace who say it is possible amid all the skepticism. We're looking at hope and hard experience as peace talks gear up again. Gadi Baltiansky is with us, Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Israel, former press secretary to Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. It's a big deal, an Israeli-Palestinian effort that has gone on for years to model and push for a two-state solution there. From the Palestinian side of that, in Ramallah, we're joined by Nidal Fukaha, Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Palestine. Here's the president at his press conference on Friday, President Obama, saying he personally would support extending the moratorium on settlement construction in the West Bank.
What I've said to Prime Minister Netanyahu is that given so far the talks are moving forward in a constructive way, it makes sense to extend that moratorium so long as the talks are moving in a constructive way.
Makes sense to extend, but at the moment, there is no sign of that extension coming. Gadi Baltiansky, in Tel Aviv, there are all kinds of headwinds here, but so we don't lose sight of it, make the fundamental case for us about how and why peace could be achieved.
Three reasons. First of all, today there is a majority on both sides which supports a kind of a compromise which serves the national interests of both parties. It is reflected in the model of the Geneva Initiative, in former President Clinton's parameters and other documents. And that's for the first time maybe in history there is such a majority for such a detailed model of agreement. Second reason is that the American president is very much committed. And I think that his commitment is very important. And without it, maybe it will be very difficult to do it. And the third reason is that the price both sides will pay for another failure can be really unthinkable. If we don't take advantage of the current opportunity, we may miss it. We may miss the models that I'm talking about. We may miss the leaderships. as my colleague said before, there is an alternative in the Palestinian side, a very extremist alternative. There are forces on both sides who don't want such a solution, and the longer we continue with the process without a solution, the more power they will get.
Nidal Fukaha, Gadi asserts that on the Israeli side, there's majority on both sides. There's majority support for a deal, for peace now, and a peace deal. Do you see that on the Palestinian side? A majority support for a deal?
Yeah, I agree with my colleague Gadi Baltiansky. Yes, there is a majority on the Palestinian side that supports a peace deal, a deal that lead to two states, an independent Palestinian state living in peace and security side by side with Israel. And within this context, I think all parties realize that it is an opportunity. Meanwhile, they fully realize that there is a challenge. And I think why I'm a little bit optimistic in this regard, the American administration is fully aware about this challenge. And I don't think this administration would allow the collapse of a process after 1 month from launching it. This will not be accepted, nor will be reasonable. Moreover, both the Palestinians and Israelis know their way and know what they want from this process, which is having an independent Palestinian state. And this state should be on a certain geography, and at the end of the day, the settlement, geo-paradise, the contiguity of this geography.
You say there's wide Palestinian support, but how does Hamas figure into that? I mean, Palestinians themselves are pretty deeply divided. Could you possibly have something work out here without Hamas being on board? They're not at the table.
I'll tell you something. The whole issue of the rise of Hamas is mainly the failure and the collapse of the peace process over 19 years. Yes, Abu Mazen, as mentioned in the introduction, he has one single program, which is a peaceful program, putting an end for this conflict through negotiations, and he actually doesn't know any other means for solving this conflict. But unfortunately, this track did not lead to tangible results for the Palestinians, which empowered the others who raised other slogans, mainly Hamas. But just in case, with the progress of the peace process, with certain tangible, significant results coming out of this process, I think the rational voices among the Palestinian society, including the current Palestinian leadership, will be much more empowered towards proposing their own program, the program of negotiation and solving this conflict through peace.
Gadi, what about on the Israeli side, where there may be people who don't want the kind of solution that's envisioned here? I've got a question from an online comment here from Michael. I don't know if this is correct, but he says, can you ask how peace can happen when the Likud charter states it will not recognize a Palestinian state or right to self-determination? Is that true? And what about that?
There is a minority among Israelis who really don't want the two-state solution. They want to remain in the West Bank because they believe in the holiness of the land, and they prefer a binational state with Jews and the Arabs alike in one state, and the continuation of the conflict as long as they stay in their settlements. But they are the minority. The problem is with the leaders. And leaders from Likud and from other parties in the past showed that they can take decisions. I don't know what will be the case of Mr. Netanyahu, but I think the challenge of all of us is to bring him and to bring the Palestinian leader to the moment of truth, the moment where they have to take a decision. The moment not of deciding about 2,000 units here or there. This is not something that has to do with the vital Israeli interest. But the real question, do we want to stay in the territories occupying another people or want to have a democratic and Jewish Israel? That's the question. And the natural tendency and the political tendency is always to postpone this moment of truth, maybe to wait. And our challenge is, maybe the American challenge as well, is to try to convince the leaders that the moment of truth cannot wait.
You say there's a minority of Israelis who want to stay in the West Bank. Does that minority include the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, the moment Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke about two states, I don't think he means that the Palestinian state will be created on the moon.
Yeah.
So the place where this state can be established is only in the West Bank and Gaza. Now, if he acts according to his words, it remains to be seen. I think we should encourage him. We should test him as we should encourage and test the Palestinian leader as well. I think this is a role of a third party, of the American administration in this case. I don't expect a solution to be imposed. I don't want it. But I think if the Israeli Prime Minister already accepted the principle of two states, I think it's only reasonable to expect from him that he will act according to his words.
And you spoke earlier about one of the primary drivers of a potential deal being the looming price of failure. What is the price of failure that you see here, and is it widely seen?
First of all, we're already paying the price of previous failures. And what you mentioned before, Tom, about the indifference or the skepticism mm-hmm. of many Israelis and Palestinians is already a price. People got used to life which is not normal, but they think that it is normal. No, it is not normal that 18-year-old kids will go for 3 years in the army on the Israeli side, or that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians throughout the years will serve time in Israeli prisons. It is not normal life. We're paying a price in economy, education, health, in everything, and, of course, a price of blood. Now, if this round collapses, and if indeed the Palestinian current leadership, who believes in a two-state solution, who opposes violence and terrorism, will disappear, then extremists on both sides will say that they were right. You cannot have peace, and let's have the extremists on both sides, from Hamas and from the Israeli right, to have one state, continue to fight each other. For me, it's the end of my dream as a Zionist to have a Jewish and democratic state. And for my colleague, Nidal Fokah, I'm sure it's the end of his dream to have a Palestinian independent state.
Dreams on the line here. Let's go to our listeners. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point was the people who are in charge of all these negotiations, if they don't have control of the people in their country, how much can you have? I mean, this only one incident can set off the whole thing and blow up all the peace processes they've had, especially since if you talk to, like, the average man on the street in Palestine, like, about a two-state solution, they'll say, oh, that's wonderful. We'll have our own country. Israel will be their own country. Then once we have our own country, we can really kill some Jews and take our land back, you know?
Brian, let me take it to Nidal. Nidal, how about it? I mean, is there enough, even if there were an agreement, is there enough control that it would be observed? And last, we saw, you know, Gaza went to the Palestinians, and then a lot of conflict since. Lots of calls for settlers to lay off. Even, you know, Israeli police and soldiers out there sometimes wrestling with settlers, but yet settlement goes on. Is there enough control for it to take place, even if it's formally agreed?
Well, I think there were past experiences regarding the implementation of agreements. And if there is or there will be an agreement in this regard, I think the government Israel will be capable of doing this issue of evacuating settlers. Definitely the process just started. It is supposed within a year from now to have a certain results. But if there is a governmental will within Israel, I think such agreement can be implemented. And we cannot judge, of course, on a certain events or activities here or there, whether by the Israelis or by the Palestinians. At the end of the day, if the Palestinian and the Israeli leadership will go for an agreement, and this agreement will be referred for referendum, I believe it will enjoy the majority and it will enjoy the support of the public, and at the end of the day, both governments will be able to implement it. And we have several experiences and several events in the region, in the Middle East, where there were agreements and both governments managed to implement them.
Nidal in Ramallah, Gadi in Tel Aviv, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, former advisor to U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations between 1978 and 2003, author of The Much Too Promised Land, Aaron David Miller, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Tom, it's a pleasure.
We've been talking with you about the goal of Arab-Israeli Mideast peace for years now. You came out and made a splash this spring, with the piece in Foreign Policy magazine headlined "The False Religion of Mideast Peace and Why I'm," that is you, "No Longer a Believer." So what about now?
You know, the reality is that if Israelis and Palestinians are ready and able to make key decisions on the core issues, and I think the time for decisions is actually coming relatively soon, and if an American mediator, a president and secretary of state, are prepared to be tough, fair, and reassuring, something we have not seen, I might add, over the last 16 years, 8 years under Bill Clinton, for whom I work, and 8 years under George W. Bush. If the answers to those questions come up yes, then you not only are you going to have a serious negotiation, but you could actually have an agreement. If either one of those questions, particularly the first one, that Abbas and Netanyahu aren't prepared to own their own negotiations, if either one comes up no, then you might as well hang a close for the season sign on the president's and anyone else's hopes for a two-state solution. So I'm not arguing that this is impossible. What I'm arguing is that the conditions that make it possible need to be in place. And frankly, over the last 16 years, they haven't been. So, you know, like the last country or the famous country song says, one more last chance.
Mm-hmm.
This is an important moment. We'll just see if the answers to both questions come up yet.
Serious and ready on key issues and a tough, fair, reassuring mediator, the USA. I mean, you were there when the U.S. had just come out of what was seen as quite successful Gulf War effort way back under George H.W. Bush, James Baker there. The U.S. looked very strong in the region. Now, much less strong. I mean, could this Obama administration, whatever its will, whatever its desire, does the U.S. have the oomph now, Aaron David Miller, to shepherd this through?
Tom, you know, that's really a core point, and you're absolutely right. In the wake of a brief moment, in the wake of Persian Gulf War I, Bush 41 and Baker were able to capitalize on the reality of American power. We were perceived to be victorious. We took on Middle East diplomacy in a serious way. Baker made 9 trips in basically 9 months to produce the Madrid Peace Conference. It wasn't nearly the kind of issues with which the parties are grappling now, but the reality is America was respected. The problem now is we're bogged down like some modern-day Gulliver, tied up by tiny tribes in Iraq and Afghanistan, jerked around by Iran that continues its search for enough fissile material to produce a weapon. And the president is bogged down in domestic travails, a jobless recovery, significant losses, presumably in November in the midterms. I think our street cred, frankly, is way, way down. So if you ask me the question, does the U.S. have the power to force Abbas and Netanyahu, or let's just take Netanyahu, the answer is absolutely not. It's not even a relevant question because we are not going to put ourselves in the position, Obama has already made that clear, where we are involved in a major confrontation with, in this case, a close American ally, with the parties buying into this, not doing it themselves. They will never produce a conflict-ending agreement by themselves. But if they own their negotiations, and it was Larry Summers who said nobody in the history of the world ever washed a rental car, because you care only about what you own. If Abbas and Netanyahu really own this, then the time will be right for an American mediator, tough, fair, and reassuring, to step in and bridge the gaps on Jerusalem border security and refugees and produce what to me now seems unlikely but still possible, a conflict-ending agreement between Israelis and Palestinians.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about hope and hard experience on the Mideast peace front as talks gear up again. Meetings having gone on today in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Everybody back toward Israel now and Jerusalem tomorrow. Well, there will be more talks. With us this hour from Tel Aviv, Gadi Baltiansky. He's Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Israel. He and Nidal Fukaha, who's Director General of the Initiative in Palestine, have worked hard on this model, a model for Mideast peace that they say can work, should work, right now. Also with us today from Washington, Aaron David Miller, author of the much too promised land, is here. God, you heard Aaron David Miller there saying you need two things: serious, for the two players, Netanyahu and Abbas, to be serious and ready with key decisions on the core issues. Number one, and number two, a tough, fair, reassuring mediator, the USA. Do you see those two things in place, Gadi?
I think that what we need is the combination of both, of course. But in order for the leaders here to take the decisions, they should be encouraged by the third party to take those decisions. As Aaron Miller said, and I fully agree with him, it should be owned by the leaders themselves and by the people themselves, the solution. But they should not avoid this moment of truth. The help from outside, from Washington in this case, should be in bringing the leaders to this crossroad, to this moment where they cannot postpone or avoid the decision. I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu was not educated, raised, or politically advocated for a two-state solution. He opposed it. But he got to this place where he is right now. President Abbas, for many years, advocated this solution. And they are there at this point with an American committed administration. I think it is an opportunity. And it's up to the leaders with the help of the people. You know, with the Geneva Initiative, we work tirelessly every day with a lot of people on both sides in order to encourage our leaders to get to this kind of solution. But we need also the help from abroad.
Gadi, you know, here we are. Muslims have just wrapped up the Ramadan holy season. Jews are in the midst of high holidays right now. In those terms, it's a time of seriousness. Do you see seriousness in these talks, or just people placating Washington, placating Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
You know, I think we don't have the luxury of not being serious about it. It is not a game or, you know, a puzzle. Either you make it or you don't make it. It's much more serious than that. It's really a question of life or death. It's a question of our basic ideology, of our own existence. So I do trust leaders that they are serious, that they want the best for their peoples. I don't think they are playing games. I think President Obama said that this is something of a national interest for the U.S. I think there's no doubt that a peaceful solution serves the national interests of the Palestinian people and of the Israeli people. So, no, I don't think it's a game, but I think in order to make it a successful process, we need an intensive interest and involvement from the Israeli leadership, the Palestinian leadership, and the American leadership. And the next month we'll say if it's happening or not.
Nidal Fukaha, you mentioned that the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, his time in office grows short if an agreement is not reached while he's there. What do you anticipate on the other side of his leadership?
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with my colleague Gadi Baltiansky that both sides must be serious in this regard. And it, in this regard, I know that the Palestinian leadership is fully serious, and they went to negotiations in order to reach, at the end of the day, a model for solving the conflict between the Palestinians and Israel. This is something very clear to the Palestinian leadership, because for Abu Mazen and his people and the people of the PLO, they adopted this line of negotiations and solving the conflict through the peace process. And God forbid, if this process did not lead to nowhere after a year from now or so, or if mm-hmm. it is announced that this process will collapse, I think it will be, at the end of the day, the end of this stream among the Palestinians. I think the Palestinians are now a little bit fed up from this a long process, and now they are looking seriously to receive some good news in this regard, some progress, some courageous decisions by both Palestinians and Israelis. And within this perspective, I think the American role is extremely important, and I think they can, not a pressure only, but first of all, they can encourage, they can positively provoke both sides towards taking serious steps in order to overcome those obstacles, mainly the obstacles of the first month, as being represented in the issue of settlement, and encouraging them more and more towards talking in detail about the form of the future Palestinian state, mainly on the issue of borders, since by reaching a certain formula on the issue of border, automatically they will solve several issues related to negotiations, including Jerusalem, including refugees, and most importantly, the issue of settlements.
Aaron Miller, I want to hear you on that. Let me get a call or two first, if I may, from Los Angeles, California. Saad is on the line. Hi, Saad. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. My question is about the points of major contention in the past, such as Jerusalem and the refugees that have resulted in deadlocks. Are either party or both parties ready to reach middle ground solutions, i.e., can you have two Jerusalem capitals? Can you have some refugees returning, part of the refugees, or no refugees returning? Are they serious about middle grounds here?
Aaron David Miller, do you see that?
I think it's a proposition worth testing. I mean, I think you're not talking any longer about interim agreements. You're not talking about an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, which involved the return of a very large and relatively distant piece of territory in exchange for a formal treaty of peace. You're not talking about an Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty, in which territory proved to be an interesting but minor issue in the consummation of the court. You are talking about the core issues of identity, political and religious, and physical security. Now, nobody right now would bank on the fact that a weak Palestinian prime minister, part of a Palestinian Humpty Dumpty, in which you have two sets of two different authorities, two different security services, two different streams of funding, two different patrons that power both Hamas and Abbas, or an Israeli prime minister who has not, he's a hawk. The question is, in the style of Menachem Begin, in the style of Yitzhak Rabin, in the style of even Ariel Sharon, is he going to be a transformed hawk? Nobody would bank on this. At the same time, as Gadi, and he knows these issues well, identified, leaders can, in fact, evolve. And that's the real question, it seems to me. I think the key to this entire process is, does not lie in Washington. I think it lies less in Ramallah than it does in Jerusalem. It's whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu, as a consequence of feeling real pain and the prospects of real gain, can make the kind of evolution in his thinking that his predecessors have made. And this is a proposition that I would argue, Tom, not even the prime minister knows right now. In fact, I've been saying that Bibi, the tough-talking Likud politician, is in conflict with Netanyahu. Only the second or the fourth Israeli prime minister to serve in non-consecutive terms, and someone who envisions himself as a historic figure. How this is going to be resolved in his own mind, I don't think is clear. Certainly not clear to me, and I'm not sure it's clear to him.
What's the real pain that you imagine him feeling that might push him from that side?
Well, this is the intriguing question. This is where you really talk about urgency, because in every other breakthrough in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and there are almost no exceptions, those breakthroughs came in response to the shifting of regional tectonic plates, either in response to war, as 73 showed, Palestinian Intifada, as 1993 showed, or before Persian Gulf War I, scrambled the eggs in the region, or in response to prospects of gain, a historic move on the part of Anwar Sadat, or a Israeli-Palestinian understanding in Oslo. So I don't know if the urgency is there. And that's an intriguing question that you have to ask. Gadi and Nidal may well believe that Barack Obama can compensate for the lack of partnership, the lack of leadership, and the lack of urgency that exists in the region right now through his own leadership, his own pressure. It's never worked that way in the past. But, you know, I have an open mind.
Gadi, you warned earlier of the price of failure as being one of the big drivers that should be pushing this toward toward peace. What's that price? And does Prime Minister Netanyahu have it in mind?
I'm sure he has it in mind. I really think that he thinks about the future of his nation, not only about the future of his political career. But I think, again, that Errol Miller is very right. I don't know, and I don't know if he knows, if he's willing to take the crucial decisions to avoid this price. I'm not sure that before the elections he thought that he will speak about two states. I don't know that he will follow for sure the steps of former prime ministers who said one thing before the elections, and all of them moved to a very specific direction after the elections. But I'm sure that we should give it a try, that we should not be indifferent or just say to ourselves, okay, they can try again, but we know that nothing will come out of it. We cannot afford this kind of despair, because then the price will be really huge for all of us here for sure, and maybe for others in the rest of the world as well. So that is why I think that at the moment of truth, I can hope, I don't know, but I can hope that the leaders will take the right decision. The only challenge is to bring them to that moment of truth.
Let's go to Philip in Boston. Philip, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just was wondering, you know, why is it that the right of return is such a contended point with Israel on the Israeli side, when it's easier for a third generation American Jew to become a citizen of Israel than it is for a person who was born in Palestine, who is a refugee, to become a citizen of Palestine? I don't understand that. Maybe one of the callers can clarify that.
Aaron David Miller, speak to that. Of course, Israel, you know, founded as a Jewish homeland, and I guess that may be self-answering. On the other hand, the right of return has never gone away from Palestinian concern or as a big sticking point in negotiations. Is there a way around it?
You know, there is a way around it. I think it is going to be a combination, and it's impossible to look at these issues independently. I think the solution to this is a package in which there are trade-offs within issues and trade-offs between issues. And on the issue of the refugee question, it will be the last piece of this. It may well be that on the two issues that are most important to Israel right now, and the Prime Minister has self-identified them as security and recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people, that somehow in responding to those, and he expects the Palestinians to do precisely that, he will have to find a way to address in a practical, symbolic way, perhaps, their identity issue, which is some combination of compensation and rehabilitation for Palestinian refugees who will not return, unlimited return to the state of Palestine, some acknowledgement by the Israelis of the legitimacy of Palestinian needs on this issue, and maybe over a period of several years, a limited number of refugees actually returning to Israel proper or returning to the areas in Israel proper that the Israelis concede, swap to the Palestinians in exchange for the West Bank territory that they are prepared to accept. In the end, however, the Palestinians will not compromise on right of return if the two other issues that are essential for their national identity, Jerusalem and territory, do not break their way. If Jerusalem and territory can be brought to meet Palestinian needs and requirements, I suspect that the refugee issue, you will find a creative solution to it. If Jerusalem and territory don't come out the right way, then, first of all, you're not going to have an agreement, and you're certainly not going to address the issue of refugees.
The right way, from the Israeli perspective, can you have a Jerusalem that's also Palestinian, with the capital of a Palestinian state, a part of it, and that's the right way for Israel?
I think that there is a solution to Jerusalem, both as a municipality, as a capital to both states, and there is a solution also to the issue of the Holy Basin and the holy sites. It's going to take extraordinary credibility, creativity, and courage for an Israeli prime minister, and a Palestinian president to basically stand in defiance of history, which has taught us one thing about Jerusalem, and that's this. It's not to be shared. Jerusalem is to be possessed in the name of God, the nation, and the tribe. To counteract that view, particularly among religious ultras on both sides, will require nothing short of a heroic action.
Nidal Fukaha in Ramallah, what would you say to Abu Mazen, President Abbas, if next week, you know, there's not a full moratorium on settlements and he's tempted to leave? Should he go for a compromise to stay in this conversation this time?
Well, I'm still hopeful for the coming few days, mainly the next 10 days, that a certain compromise will be reached between both sides, the Palestinians and the Israelis, with the assistance and the mediation of the Americans. So far, I'm not sure what the form of such compromise will look like, but it might be a partial freeze. Mainly there will be no increase or building outside the border of the settlements, or the building will be vertical, not horizontal. I think the both sides entered into this process, and they fully know that they cannot withdraw from it after a week from its relaunching.
Nidal Fukaha, Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Palestine, with a note there of hope in a region that needs hope, and we will end on that. Nidal, thank you very much. And Gadi Baltiansky, Director General of the Geneva Initiative in Israel, former Press Secretary to Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Mr. Baltiansky, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom, for having us.
Aaron David Miller, author of The Much-Too-Promised Land, thank you as always for joining us.
Pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thank you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.